isn't just for alumni, it's for the whole Kingston community. Join us Saturday, October 20th from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. for the Fall Harvest Gathering at Agnes Benedictson Field. Enjoy live music, face painting, lawn games, and the flavors of Kingston's finest food trucks. Plus, explore a pop-up vendor market featuring local artisans. This free outdoor event celebrates the season and brings together friends, family, and community. Visit queensu.ca/alumni/homecoming for more info.
Down the short set of stairs, join me, Grim, in the basement for my working knowledge of indie, experimental, post-punk, and electronic. Every Wednesday from 10 until 11 p.m. on CFRC 101.9 FM. Get ready to press record.
Hello, welcome to Viewpoints on today's show. Well, I'll be out, and journalist Jules Bigiel will be in with a documentary produced in Montreal, Quebec, about urban agriculture.
There are hundreds of thousands of fruit trees on private land that go unharvested every year. It's due to a lack of knowledge about those trees and a lack of social cohesion between the people who own the land and between the people who would like to harvest them. And so the goal of the collective is really to put in contact citizens and neighbors and residents of different neighborhoods in Montreal to allow those harvests to take place and then redistribute those fruits between the people who participated and the people who live in the neighborhood to ensure that they're going to be used and accessible by the people who live around them.
Montreal is home to 200 social, collective, and private initiatives, as well as 50% of urban farms. But climate change is playing the boogeyman, and citizens and environmental organizations are feeling the pinch.
So the scarabée has been very problematic now for like at least 5 years in Quebec, but it definitely is a bug that has established itself more and more in the Northeast as it becomes more and more warm and our winters get milder, and it's like range of habitat moves more towards the north with climate change. So it's definitely something we've seen explode in the last few years in Quebec.
Welcome to Viewpoints, local news nationwide.
You are on the air with Viewpoints. Listen to all our stories on frequencynews.ca.
Hello, welcome to this special edition of Viewpoints. My name is Boris Chassagne-Well. I'm off on vacation, and during that time, we'll have the great pleasure to have three journalists who will be filling in for me over the next few weeks with four great documentaries, and Jules Bigiel in Montreal will be the first. Jules, who will today tell us more about the importance of local urban agriculture and how it's being affected by climate change, even in the heart of the city. Jules visited a local farm as well as an urban orchard for this story. Urban agriculture is very popular in Montreal. The city is covered with community gardens. Tourism Montreal goes as far as to say that Montreal is one of the urban agriculture capitals. This thanks to a study conducted by AU Lab, the Laboratoire de l'Agriculture Urbaine, who compared 10 major world cities, including Brussels, London, Paris, New York, Toronto, and Vancouver. Montreal, who has its green roofs over the top of the Palais des Congrès and the commercial Lufa Farms, which built the world's first commercial rooftop greenhouse on an industrial building in Montreal. Montreal that dedicated some 25 hectares to some 100 community gardens. Close to 12,000 gardeners cultivate them. However, as popular as it is, sustainable urban agriculture had a rough ride over the past years, hit by unusual weather patterns, heavy rainfalls, lengthy dry spells, unusual warm weather for the season, insect infestations, and so on. So Jules Bigiel wanted to get in touch with some of the people who are in the center of the action. Here she is.
Summer brings the people of Montreal out of our apartments and into our streets and green spaces. Perhaps none more so, the Mont-Royal itself. But even though you'll see people flock to the mountain and Parc Jean Mons at its base, most Montrealers never get to see another green space just a stone's throw away. Behind the thick stone walls of La Cité des Hospitaliers, there's a whole other world. A little green oasis at the corner of Park and Pine.
You feel like very peaceful and alone and apart from what's happening right outside the walls. Like, right there is the volleyball courts, there's the Parc Jeanne-Mance, but it's like very like dépaysant. Like, you don't hear it, you don't see it, you feel like you're somewhere else.
This is Simone Chen, coordinator of Fruits Défendus, a citizen collective for urban gleaning that's been operating in the city since 2011. And in the orchard since around 2013.
There are hundreds of thousands of fruit trees on private land that go unharvested every year. And it's really due to a few factors that are very easy to address. It's due to a lack of knowledge about those trees and a lack of social cohesion between the people who own the land and between the people who would like to harvest them. And so the goal of the collective is really to put in contact citizens and neighbors and residents of different neighborhoods in Montreal to allow those harvests to take place and then redistribute those fruits between the people who participated and the people who live in the neighborhood to ensure that they're going to be used and accessible by the people who live around them.
Volunteers mostly go to people's private trees. The collective also works here in La Cité. Once run as part of a religious hospital and convent, this orchard is one of the few and certainly one of the oldest left in the city.
There's about 50 trees that are left from what the orchard used to be here. It used to be a more diversified fruit orchard with peaches, pears, plums. There's still two plum trees left, but the rest are apple trees. The sisters sold this land to the city in 2019, and ever since then it's been kind of a transition period where the city is trying to find ways that they can continue to keep the patrimonial vocation of the site while at the same time creating a space that can be used by the community and used by the larger public also.
But even before the collective came along or the city stepped in, members of the community would come and pick the extra apples.
I know some people who used to come here and do some urban gleaning in like the 80s and 90s. So it's a long tradition that is that we're keeping alive with the collective, but we're not the first.
It's a testament to how much interest there is in urban gleaning and urban agriculture more broadly.
In Montreal, it's a city where there's a lot of interest and motivation for people to be involved in urban agriculture and food production. So there are a lot of people that would love to go harvest trees, but they don't have land and they don't have a tree.
Something I was really, because I'm not from Montreal, and when I got here, I was so surprised that instead of flowers in a pot, you had kale and mint and things you could pick, and I didn't know you could pick them, and I thought that was crazy.
Rayanne Fawaz works at OLAB, Montreal's big urban agriculture incubator. We met at one of their early projects, a collective garden at UQAM. It's a different approach than with community gardens, which is the classic model of how things are grown within the city.
The community garden would be each one his own plot, each one his own decisions and who's going to plant what at what season, but they get all the production of the gardens come to the individual. So you kind of have to sign up for these. A lot of the time the wait lists are very long, probably you've heard of that, like more than 10 years to get your own little plot. So it's really luck at this point. For the collective gardens, it's more of a everybody takes everything kind of mentality. Like everybody comes together to plant together, to take things together. Even some gardens, like the one on the street of Mont-Royal, that's a very temporary garden along the street, is open to everyone. So there's a collective planting everything, and then anyone can come and pick everything, like the people from the neighborhood.
Projects like the one at UQAM, what the city calls social and collective urban agriculture, really started taking off in the 2010s, going from just 75 in the city to almost 250. Rayanne says she's been shocked at how well they work in practice.
Before working here, I went through these gardens and I was like, obviously it doesn't work. Like, how do people get along and how do people communicate to not pick too much? Because if it was up to me, I would take everything. But I guess that a lot of people have a lot more conscience than we think. So they pick only what they want. Everything is written down, like how to do it, when to do it. If a plant is too small, it says, don't pick now, wait until I have enough leaves, which is such a cute thing to do. And people actually respect that. And I've sat there for a while and I see people coming with their own little bags and picking just what they need for their salad. Obviously, these gardens are not meant for you to eat from them on the long, like you're not trying to feed your family of four. It's literally just a little initiative to bring people together to communicate, and I feel like people know that.
OLAB has other projects. big public buildings growing food on their roofs, a hub where urban agriculture businesses share equipment and ideas. But they all share a core concern, creating connection between the people of Montreal and the food they eat. For Rianne, that connection is personal.
In general, a lot of people ask me if urban agriculture can replace agriculture or can even, you know, get as big as we need it to be for the growing population. And it's always no. And it's always, okay, what's the point then? When it comes to me specifically, initially I wanted to be a cook or work in a restaurant. And then the more I went into that, the more I got pulled out from the charm of restoration because there was so much waste and there was so much lack of connection to the food we were eating, which led me to go into agriculture. And it's kind of inevitable whenever you're working with food and you kind of realize how much goes into it, how much time and effort and like, you can't throw a tomato after working in urban agriculture, and that's the or any agriculture. Like, when you see how much time goes into it and how cheap we buy our food and how, yeah, I mean, you kind of awaken this new perception of, like, the food you eat, which I think we should all have, which is why urban agriculture is amazing, because everyone has access to it, and that's a main thing. Like, every resident needs to have access to a certain farm. If you talk to anyone, most people don't know where their food comes from, so something to work on.
Okay.
What is my surprise
flower?
I do?
Yes. And your surprise basket is a single today?
Yeah.
So, you got one.
This is our busiest drop-off so far this year, and we prepared 103 baskets to leave, and so we have 2.5 hours to distribute 103 baskets, and we're almost done. It's like, you can see there's not much food left.
This is Jenna Jacobs, co-founder of La Ferme Coop aux Champs qui Chantent, the farm where the fields sing. We're just catching up on Avenue Duluth, where she's delivering fresh fruits and veg from her farm, located just over an hour outside the city.
The system is like, there's some bins where everybody gets one thing from that bin, and then there's other things that are choices. And I put the choices side by side, so the seasoned clients know which ones to take.
The farm is unique in many ways. It's earned a rep among its mostly Montreal-based supporters as a queer farm, a co-op farm, and more recently, a pro-Palestine farm.
You want to see the sheep over here?
Oh, yeah.
But it's also part of a larger movement of local agriculture here in Quebec.
Our farm and other farms, we push this idea of the family farmer. And so lots of us have like a family doctor, family dentist, even family mechanics and other things. But we don't necessarily have a family farmer. So when people come to get their food, there's a farmer there present. And so I talk to people about like the growing conditions. People are curious what's happening on the farm. I talk to them about the different vegetables. I know all these vegetables pretty well. I'm the one that goes out into the field and chooses what's in the basket. And I really want to choose the things that are going to be the most delicious and the most abundant for people in their baskets.
Different ones.
I mean, our harvest list is huge right now. The amount of things that are ready that we can put in a basket is quite large. And so it's just like right now we're trying to like prioritize things that won't hold in the field. Like some things like beets and carrots, you know, we can leave them there a few extra weeks and it doesn't change anything. But other things like broccoli, you cut it and then it doesn't keep for very long. It doesn't keep for very long on the plant.
I do really believe that this is like a really sustainable way to grow food, to grow it on a small scale, like highly diversified, purchasing straight from farmers. Like it feels to me like it's really efficient. When I see the larger food distribution system in Quebec where we're trucking in for food or even harvesting it from big farms, it's going through like, you know, one, two different middle people before it's actually getting to the consumer. And so the food's older, you're paying a lot of middle people for like just moving stuff around. When I feel like the way we do it, pull it out of the fields, you know, we put it into our cold room one night and then bring it into Montreal. It seems like, to me, it seems really efficient of a way to do it. And then we're also like way less impactful, I think, like to just have less of an ecological impact from these activities.
Back at UQAM, the ecological impacts are also on Rayanne's mind. Part of OLAB's work is in developing projects toward a circular economy.
They use the waste of breweries, for example, that create brewing waste or malt or wheat that already has been, the flavors have been extracted from them, but they still have a lot of nutrients. So they send those to mushroom farms that will then use the leftover nutrients to grow mushroom and then compost the rest. And then this compost can then go into a communal garden that will feed the garden in any leftover nutrients, because there's so much happening in those little substances that you can really extract from them as much as possible. So let's say these go to feed the gardens, then all the production from the gardens would then go to another collective that will use them to transform products to eat or even in a restaurant. So we're really talking about a closed loop where we try to waste as little as possible.
And there's another feature to a lot of these projects, and that's climate resilience.
Urban agriculture is a lot more resilient to climate change because it's controlled environments most of the time. When it's not outside, it's inside. It can be in a serre, in a greenhouse, or it can be in the basement or in any kind of form that it's controlled. So obviously they're a lot less affected by climate change.
But other types of local agriculture may not have that same control. At the Fail Mochon-Quichon's, they're seeing the impacts of climate change firsthand.
Like a late frost in the spring or an early frost in the fall is like really devastating for us. It's like we can lose tons of stuff. I think more what we're seeing, instead of like this kind of blanket statement of things being earlier, is just more chaos.
That's why these days, Jenna and the team are making some changes to the way they grow things.
The way we're moving and following the lead of some other farms is to have more what we call protected culture in the spring. And so this is, these are vegetables grown under plastic, so like greenhouse structures. And we're able to just regulate the weather or the climate a little bit better inside of these structures. And so we're in the process on this farm of building the biggest greenhouse we're going to have. It's going to almost triple the amount of space we have under protected culture.
But some climate impacts are harder to manage than others.
Most of our vegetables are hand harvested, hand planted. And so where we're seeing it hit the hardest is on the employees, on the people that work on the farm. And so like the heat waves is most of it. And trying to work through these heat waves, the heat wave we had last week, for example, it was tough. You know, we were seeing like temperatures like in the 30s, like 32, 34, feels like 40. And it's just like, it makes it for really hard conditions to work in.
There is a machine that we've used in the past. This year, it's just not really working for two. Like it goes behind the tractor that kind of cuts under the garlic, and then it loosens everything, makes it a lot easier to harvest. But yeah, we have too many weeds this year.
One of the folks harvesting garlic was Al, who says they love being outside at the farm, but find it difficult to work during the hot summer months.
Yeah, it's really intense, and I guess I get really affected by the heat pretty intensely, so get heat exhaustion very quickly. I think from getting, you know, once you get heat stroke once, it actually is just, you're more susceptible. Yeah, so I don't know, we've like brought out a big cooler for everybody to have access to water all the time. And
so helpful.
Yeah, try to have some, I don't know, if people need longer breaks or this kind of thing. I think there's, I mean, also when there is the wildfires, when we're affected by the wildfire smoke, there's like, I mean, there are links to climate change for that. And that's also really, that was really intense last year for us here, and obviously horrible for many people this year too.
This is one super good example of the diga that are caused by a Japanese beetle, which we see here procreating. They make this, they eat the leaves and they make this kind of like lace pattern, and then the leaf can't do any more photosynthesis and it causes a lot of delays in the growth. So you see it's been like completely destroyed. And you can see there's still scarabée japonais everywhere.
Back at the orchard, Simone is seeing big changes year to year. This year, bugs are decimating their summer apples. She says that ever since the orchard changed hands, the city of Montreal stopped spraying the trees. An end to pesticide use isn't a bad thing, but it hasn't been replaced with an alternative. and climate change is making the problem worse.
So the scarabée has been very problematic now for like at least 5 years in Quebec, but it definitely is a bug that has established itself more and more in the Northeast as it becomes more and more warm and our winters get milder, and it's like range of habitat moves more towards the north with climate change. So it's definitely something we've seen explode in the last few years in Quebec.
It's not just invasive species causing problems. Local insect populations are undergoing big changes too.
This year, there are a lot of caterpillars, like a really exponentially huge amount of caterpillars that make these like webs in the trees that can also be very damaging to the growing cycle of the tree, because the caterpillars will eat through the leaves of the tree and once again disrupt the photosynthesis of the tree and interrupt its ability to grow. So because we had such a mild winter this year, we had like an explosion of these caterpillar populations all over Quebec this year. If they're controlled, it can be manageable, but at the same time, it's really kind of shocking to see such a huge amount of damage caused in 1 year by an insect that in the past wasn't considered that much of a problem.
The orchard may be a niche case, but in some ways, it's representative of an approach to agriculture in transition. If the transition isn't complete, the trees aren't going to thrive.
The only good solution would be to ensure there's as much diversity as possible, because the only way we can have resilience in an ecosystem is through diversity of species, of plants, of cultivars. So for example, when we have a problem of a certain insect in the orchard, the problem isn't the insect. The problem is that we're lacking the predators that predate that insect. Why? We don't have the habitat for the predators to be present in this kind of sterilized, domesticated setting. So it's a setting around us where we see a lot of lawn, we see a lot of apple trees. That's it. That's not a ecosystem. So if we want to be able to combat the insects that come to attack the trees in this setting, because they're kind of like an easy target, because there's, you know, it's a perfect place for, example, a Japanese beetle to come install itself, because there's nothing but apple trees and lawn. When we set ourselves up for failure like this and lack that diversity and lack the ability to plant the kind of native plants and the different flowering plants and the different plants that should be in an indigenous habitat, we throw everything out of balance, and that allows more disequilibrium to pursue. So knowing that we're going to be facing even more stressing conditions coming with all of the extremes in weather that's coming, all of the different fungal and insect problems that will be coming as the weather warms in Montreal and we move up a zone, the only good response is to ensure that we are planting really good diverse habitats that are going to be interesting for those native animals to come live in a way that will create, kind of bio controls and checks naturally.
Diversity can also be in terms of the crops that are grown. That way, if one thing does poorly, there are others ready to take its place.
We can often think of the diversity creating like resilience. So in any year, there's always some cultures that do better, some crops that do better, some crops that do worse. And having a huge diversity means that like there's always going to be a climate for something to do better. This year, for example, due to some of the early conditions, it feels like our weed pressure is pretty high, and so it's not been a good year for things like carrots and beets. But some of the other cultures where we were doing a little bit better on, the tomatoes are doing great this year, cucumbers, zucchinis all did great, and so us having that diversity and being a basket farm as well allows us to kind of alter what we give people to reflect what's doing well on the farm. So we don't have a set menu through the year. It's like every week I walk through the farm and I see what's ready, and that's what goes in the basket.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good.
Good.
Hello.
Say hi, Sue.
Sue, who coordinates the farm pickups on Avenue Duluth, says the benefits aren't just in changing our food systems or the way that people connect to them. They're also in connecting people to each other.
for me, it's like a really beautiful thing to see people sharing recipes, sharing ways to prepare food, having conversations about ethical food practices and the necessity to have small farms for biodiversity. People are just so incredibly grateful to get as kind of as ethical food as you can get in Montreal. Like, given that we're on occupied territory, this is as ethical as it gets. And so people are thrilled to be here. And for me, I think it's really important to try to create, even if I have just like a 2-minute interaction with someone, I want that interaction. I want people to feel connected. I want people to feel like they matter. I want people to feel like this is a place that they can come and chat, even if they feel like it. And so we do develop relationships with people, you know, like I definitely have over the last 3 years.
And that connection is something Jenna feels as well.
Like, I really enjoy bringing my food here to like feed the people of the city, because I think they need this kind of food. But it's also really nice that like the connection with the clients. I see them week to week, and then like there's a bunch of people here I've seen several years in a row now too. So like I've seen babies get born, I've seen kids grow up, I've seen people grow older, yeah, including myself. I didn't have gray hair when I started this, right? And now I got these beautiful gray streaks in my hair.
And there is some truth to that, that connections can form just over a piece of fruit. Back in the Orchard of La Cité, most of the summer apples were too ravaged by bugs to fruit. But even there, among traps thick with beetles, we managed to find it. One perfect apple.
Wow.
Oh, elle est belle. C'est la première fois que j'ai vu ça. What the fuck?
Belle. Presque.
Yeah. Do you want it?
Can I bite
into
it?
Yeah,
yeah.
Hopefully there's no surprise in there.
Bien chaud.
Wait.
Let's try it.
Yeah. How's it?
Good. You want?
Ils sont prêts.
Mmm. No. It's actually good.
Une petite dernière qui c'est... Ça devait être vraiment la dernière.
Je suis étonnée. Tu veux goûter?
Non, c'est que j'en ai mangé déjà.
I'm Jules Bijal, reporting with the Local Journalism Initiative. Thanks for listening.
So our Montreal journalist, Jules Bijal, had the last bite. After all, thanks so much to her and her guests for filling in for us this week, a great documentary about urban agriculture initiatives. Viewpoints is brought to you by the Community Radio Fund of Canada with the support of the Local Journalism Initiative. For comments, story ideas, or just to tell us more about yourself, village, city, or country, our email is radio@frequencynews.ca. So that's it for us this week, and until the next, ciao.
Our email is radio@frequencynews.ca.
Radio@frequencynews.ca.
October 1st and 2nd, you can meet over 115 employers in the main gym of the Athletics and Recreation Center. If you are considering a career in engineering, computing, or technology fields, then join us on October 1st for the Engineering and Technology Fair. On October 2nd, many top companies, organizations, and schools will be at the Career and Further Education Fair. While you're there, visit the Career and Resume Advising Cafe and the free LinkedIn photo booth. Both events are open to all Queen's students of all years and run from 10:30 a.m. to 3:30 p.m.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another episode of Plugged in My Ears. This is your Thanksgiving special. My name is Sam. I'm one of your hosts. Today, I'm not joined by the two other hosts that are usually here, Kyle and Adam. They are away at the moment, but that's no issue because there's lots to talk about, specifically in the NHL. At the time of this recording, it's October 13th, which means that today, this evening, the Minnesota Wild will play the Jets. Calgary Flames will play the Oilers, the Kraken will play the Stars, and the Ducks will play the Golden Knights. So that'll be fascinating to watch. But yesterday was most certainly a hockey night in Canada Day because there were lots of games. There were essentially unlimited games to watch, and some of them were pretty fascinating, and there's a lot to be said for some performances. Specifically, the Kings and the Bruins had a fantastic game. I'm not sure if anyone had the opportunity to watch that, but it was a 2-1 win for the Bruins in overtime. Pastrnak and Lindholm scoring both the goals for the Bruins and Trevor Moore scoring for the Kings. That was a pretty tight game. And what I really liked about that is that it gave us a bit of insight into what the playoffs might look like. Now, I'm not trying to say that the Bruins and the Kings are both going to make the Stanley Cup Finals and that they'll end up playing each other, but they're both playoff contenders. And I would say Stanley Cup contenders too. A little bit, not as much for the Bruins, but I think the Kings have a better chance. They have a bit of a younger team and some more talent per se. Nonetheless, though, a remarkable game, and this is what the NHL needed to kickstart the season again. I think this was a great weekend, not a home opener for either team, but still a great game. Now, on the other hand, it was a home opener for the Maple Leafs yesterday. They faced off against the Pittsburgh Penguins. That game, a little bit different. The Penguins went up first, scoring the first goal of the game, a beautiful shot from Letang off a nice little pass from Crosby. I'm saying a nice little pass, really. He just gave him the puck. It wasn't that much of a pass or anything like that. But nonetheless, beautiful shot. And then the Maple Leafs kind of gave it to the Pens. They were by far the most dominant team. And if you're a Toronto Maple Leafs fan, I think there's a lot of positives to take out of this game. Marner looked phenomenal. He scored a brilliant goal off the rush, put it right under the goalie's blocker off the sidewall. That's not easy to do off the sidewall. There's not that much to shoot at, but he took a pretty good shot there. I thought that was pretty good. And, you know, Pittsburgh's not an amazing team this year, and I don't think anyone's saying that they are, but the Toronto Maple Leafs' ability to completely shut down any of the Penguins' offense the whole game was remarkable. Now, I don't know exactly the formation that Toronto uses, but they were playing some hybrid of a 2-1-2 or 1-2-2. Essentially, though, anytime they played a 1-2-2, they clogged up the middle, which is exactly what they wanted to do. And when they were doing a 2-1-2, they were making the Penguins' defensemen make terrible mistakes and turnovers the whole game. So clearly, they've been working on that quite nicely. But on the other hand, if you're a Penguins fan, you have to be wondering, well, where do we go from here? Penguins are now 1-2. They lost this game 4-2. They lost their last game 6-0. Before this, it's not great. I mean, Malkin had 2 assists, so you can't be terribly upset with that. Crosby had a point this past game and three shots on goal, which is okay. Chris Letang obviously scoring that nice goal, and Ricard Raquel scoring a nice goal as well. But who else do they have? I mean, the Penguins have a serious issue. I don't think they're going to be able to survive. I mean, Kyle Dubas, and we spoke about this on a previous episode, said that no one really expects Penguins to be good, but that they still have a fighting chance. Unfortunately, I don't think that's true anymore. I don't know that they have a fighting chance. They just lack offensive capabilities. I mean, look, Erik Karlsson was kind of absent last year for a guy who's getting paid so much. He was kind of absent yesterday too. So it's not free pickings. It's not going to be easy. if Pittsburgh really wants to make a push like they say they do, then they have to change something. Something has to change. They need to make a few trades and get some younger, better guys. Or somehow Sidney Crosby at age almost 37, in fact, he might even be 37, somehow is going to have to start putting up more points a game. And that's not easy to do when he doesn't have many guys to work with. I mean, look, if Malkin's 39 too. He's pretty old. Like, they need some younger stuff. But it is what it is, I guess, in that capacity. The Devils, though, beat the Capitals 5-3 yesterday. Eric Halla, 3 assists, not bad whatsoever. And Paul Cotter, 2 goals. But some other people who you would have expected some more from, a little bit absent. Like Jack Hughes, 0 points in a 5-2 win. That's not ideal. Hit 2 shots on goal, though, which is nice. New Jersey's going to be a good team. It's nice to see that other people are scoring. It just would have been interesting to see if guys like Dougie Hamilton and Jack Hughes could have put some pucks in the back of the net and gotten some points. But nonetheless, nothing to complain about, really, if you're a New Jersey Devils fan. I will point out, just on the topic of Newfoundland, because my mom's there, Dawson Mercer from Newfoundland, from Gander, scored yesterday. That was nice to see. 1 point, 1 shot, or sorry, 2 shots on net. One of them was a goal. Can't ask for much more than that. And for the Capitals, Jordan Carlson with 2 points, 4 shots on goals. That's not bad. 1 goal, 1 assist. Dylan Strome, 1 goal, 1 assist, 2 points, 4 shots on goal also. You know, that's a solid game in a 5-3 defeat. And OV got an assist, so that's, at least he's still doing good. It'll be interesting to see what happens with OV in his future. I'm not sure that he will stick around for too much longer in the NHL. And no, that's a kind of contested thing to say, but this doesn't come out of the fact that I'm not his biggest fan. In fact, I actually have nothing against OV, mostly. It's just that I think it's very refutable when people say he's better than Sidney Crosby. But I bring to your attention that he honestly, simply because Ovi's older than Crosby. I mean, this guy's 38. He's doing good for a 38-year-old. And I think that if there is to be a year in which he will surpass the great one in goals, it will have to be projected and propelled by this year. If he can have good success this year, then he can coast a bit in the years to follow and potentially pass it. Although I'm not sure that we want that record ever to be broken, and that's something hockey fans are going to have to sit down and think about. Do we want someone to break the great one's record? And that is not evident to me. Not evident whatsoever. If someone breaks Wayne Gretzky's record, is he still the great one? And as any patriotic Canadian that considers this, they'll have to acknowledge the fact that, you know, maybe this isn't entirely Canada's sport anymore. It's a pretty international sport. So it's interesting. It'll be very interesting to see what kind of effect that'll have on the social fabric of the hockey world in Canada. And by virtue of having an effect on the hockey world, it will have effect on what it is to be Canadian. So that is going to be fascinating to see. A few other games still left to go over from yesterday. Well, Ottawa lost 4-1 to Montreal. If Adam was here, he'd have something to say about that, no doubt. And quite frankly, as a Senators fan, I thought that Montreal was by far the better team. I don't really think anyone can say otherwise. I mean, they kind of dominated them the whole game. Ottawa couldn't really get that many chances. And Ullmark played great, by the way. Ullmark had a good game. He didn't play bad. He saved 26 shots on 30. That's pretty good. That is pretty good. So I have no issue with that whatsoever. The issue that game, I think, for Ottawa was mostly just a structural breakdown. Because they were working hard. That wasn't their issue. Most certainly not. Ottawa's issue mostly stemmed from the fact that they just couldn't get it in the back of the net. And I don't think they had enough shots on net. I mean, look, Montembeau made 24 saves, sorry, on 25 shots. That's pretty good, but there's also something to be said for taking a high caliber shot. And I don't know that the Sens were doing enough of that yesterday. Speaking of which, though, Cole Caulfield didn't take a high-caliber shot, but took a scored a ridiculous goal off a low-caliber shot. I'm saying caliber here. Shots on a low caliber was the shooting angle. That was bad. But, man, somehow he put down the top corner from essentially the side of the net. I don't know how Linus Ullmark could have stopped that in the first place, but that was a pretty cool thing to watch. Although, this is interesting news. Not public information so much. I'm not sure how reputable my sources are here, although sources whom are close to me spotted Tim Stützle of the Ottawa Senators at a happy fish after the Sens home opener this past week. And a few other Senators were there too. So no doubt they wanted to celebrate a great start to the season with a win. However, as I was reminded by my good friends, one has to consider if that may have had an impact on this loss against Montreal. Now, it most certainly was not a direct impact if it was, but point is, and it's not to take away from the fact that NHLers do go out and they're regular people and they're allowed to go have a good time. Although, should a team like Ottawa, who's been historically bad, have their players going out for a couple pints after a win, when really they should probably get back to the drawing board and keep working on their craft so they can become better and continue to win games? There's something to be said for that. I mean, I don't know what the exact answer is here, and I'm not really sure what the moral of the story is. Although, and we've heard this on this podcast before because Kyle and I have spoken about it since we have friends in the industry in Ottawa, but these Sens guys really go out and hit the town a lot. I mean, look, I wasn't a fantastic hockey player, so if I had a beer, it might impact me a lot more than these guys who have this beautiful natural ability to go and score goals. Although I can tell you, I certainly wasn't having a beer after a win. After a win, I was probably hitting the bike because I either knew that I needed to work harder or I simply had gas left in the tank and I wanted to burn it off. So, it'll be interesting to see what comes of that. I'm not sure if that's a great thing for the Senators, though, to be hitting the town so often. But who am I to judge? I don't play in the NHL. I'm just a guy with a podcast. Panthers Sabres. Honestly, I didn't watch that game because I thought the Panthers were going to sweep the floor with the Sabres, but that didn't happen. The Sabres won 5-2. Florida with two losses this season. Buffalo with three, but this is a win for them. Sam Bennett scoring for the Panthers and Nate Schmidt also. Rest of their team kind of absent. Although, a decent amount of shots on net. I mean, Spencer Knight, goalie for Florida, made 22 saves on 26 shots with a .46 save percentage. It's not terrible. It's not great, though. He's got to pick that up. And then the Sabres just turned it on yesterday. Alex Tuck, goal and assist, 2 points, 3 shots on goal. Pretty good. Pretty good. Jack Quinn with one assist. Rasmus Dahlin, an assist. You know, great diversity of points here. Tage Thompson with a goal and 3 shots on net. But yeah, great diversity of points here. This is beautiful to see. If I'm a Sabres fan, I'm looking at this with great excitement because everyone on the roster, essentially, except for like the last few people, had an offensive night. And that's pretty good. You can't complain about that. And Devin Levi stepping it up big time with 25 shots against, 23 saves, 2 goals let in, and a .92 save percentage. That's pretty phenomenal. And as some of you will remember, because I've spoken about this before, I played against Devin Levi in junior, and he has most definitely stepped it up a few notches to go play in the NHL. So that is remarkable. And I think that the Sabres might have a better season than we had once anticipated on this podcast. So I'm hoping they can prove us wrong. Utah 6-5 against the Rangers in overtime, a high-scoring game, 11 goals. Now, what's funny is that when Crosby entered the NHL in 2005, 2006, 7, etc., the average goals per game scored for both teams tallied together was 3. This past season in the NHL, it was 7. So what does that tell you? Who knows? But this game is really indicative of that. 11 goals scored is a significant amount. Clayton Keller had 2 goals and assists, 3 points, 3 shots on net. that is a great night for him. Great night. And a few multi-point nights, or multi-point players last night, sorry, for Utah. Barrett Hayton had two points, one goal, one assist. Nick Schmaltz, two assists. Pretty good evening. I don't think they can complain about that either. Like, that is a good night. And Connor Ingram made a lot of saves. I mean, 34 shots against 29 saves. You can't ask for much more from your goaltender than that. That's pretty good. The Rangers also had a few multi-point players. I mean, Adam Fox has three assists after that game. Artemi Panarin, two goals, four shots on net. That's a lot of offensive prowess. Alexis Lafreniere from Quebec, one assist, two shots on net. Pretty good night for him as well. Trouba with an assist. That's not too common for him. He's more of a hitter. So, you know, as much as that was a rough game and that the Rangers lost and had six goals let in, they played pretty good. Now, what I would be a bit concerned about is Shesterkin letting in six goals on 26 shots. That is not what I would describe as ideal. Now, I'm no doubt this is just a little bump in the road for Shesterkin. I don't really think it's going to have that much impact on him, and I don't think we should even hold that against him. But nonetheless, for a guy who says he has no loyalty to the Rangers, letting in six goals, on 26 shots is not going to get you signed very quickly for a lot of money by another team. So perhaps his arrogance will come and bite him in the bum. Moving on, the Islanders and the Stars. Or sorry, actually, I guess I'll do Islanders, Stars, and Detroit and Nashville. Both the scores are 3-0. The Stars coming on top and the Red Wings coming on top. It's pretty impressive when you shut a team out entirely like that. I mean, look, the Predators didn't even play that bad. Like, Saros, their goalie, still made 19 saves on 21 shots. It's a .95 save percentage. Or .905 save percentage. That's pretty good. There's nothing to complain about there. Meanwhile, the Red Wings have a lot to talk about. Shut out for Cam Talbot, and rightfully so. He played well when he had to. But a lot of other guys, pretty quiet. Patty Kane, one shot on net. That's not what you want to see. DeBrincat, same thing. One shot on net. Not what you want to see. That you'd be looking for more on a night like this. But Dylan Larkin stepped up to the plate big time with a goal and two shots on net. Some other guys here. 5 points, but you know, not that many shots as a whole. You gotta wonder what that really insinuates and what that really means. Detroit did put up three goals in the net, but not from the guys you would expect to produce offense. And that could be indicative of the fact that Detroit's newfound good era may slowly be slipping through their fingers again. Now, what's really cool though is people often forget about this. Before Pavel Datsyuk and Zetterberg left the Red Wings, both for different reasons, but they both left, Detroit had made the playoffs for 25 consecutive years. 25. That is a legacy that any team would die to have. And Detroit's trying to reproduce that now, and they're doing a good job. They're going in the right direction. But their guys, their reliable guys, were not reliable yesterday. And they were saved by the bell. So, in essence, that actually is a good thing because it means that clearly they have some depth. Although, I think if you win 3-0, you want one of your big guys to put up a point at least. That's what matters most. That's what matters most. And that's the sign of a healthy team. And I'm not saying Detroit's unhealthy. I'm just saying that Detroit needs to diversify who's putting the puck in the back of the net a little bit more. Now, let's go into the out of the 3-0 win. Brooklyn or New York, I don't know what their actual name is anymore, but the Islanders. No goals for them. Varlamov, though, actually played quite well. 26 shots against, 24 saves. .923 save percentage. There's nothing to complain about there. But on the other hand, I mean, look, Bo Horvat had a bit of a rough night. Four shots on net, no goals. That's a lot of shooting and not a lot of scoring. And you do want shots, but you need goals also. And that's gonna come back and be a problem for them, quite frankly, if they can't score. And they're not off to a great start this season. No wins yet. A tie and a loss. Well, an overtime loss and a loss. Not ideal. Not ideal for them at all. And I actually think that the Islanders are not a bad team, but they're going to have to pick it up quite a bit if they want to continue. If they just want to start winning. First of all, if they want to continue losing, then they're doing fine. But if they want to start winning, they got to pick it up a bit. The Stars, though, a few players putting up most of the points. Tyler Seguin, 2 goals. Now, funny story, I was with a few of my friends yesterday, and my buddy on his hockey fantasy sat out Tyler Seguin. That was a mistake, apparently, because he showed up big time. Jamie Benn with a goal also, the two former superstars of that team, really, really coming together and doing what they used to do quite nicely. So that was nice to see. And then, of course, Ottinger with 100% save percentage and 34 shots against 34 saves. That's a reliable goaltender, ladies and gentlemen. That's exactly what you're looking for in a team, a goalie who can make important saves and stops just like that. Now, only a few more games to talk about from that past night. Another final that went into extra time, so far that it went to shootouts, was the Kraken's win against the Wild. Now, the Kraken, 5 goals, the Wild, 4, shootout. Again, a few players with multi-point nights. Burakovsky with 2 assists. Eberle, 2 goals. That is a surprise. Eberle is not a huge, huge goal scorer, although I'm really happy to see that he put up a few points. Jared McCann, 1 goal, 1 assist. Beautiful as well, with 4 shots on net. Nothing to complain about there. So just a great night for them. And Joey Decor with 38 saves or 38 shots against 34 saves, 0.895. You know, that's a pretty good night too. That's a lot of saves. He really kept them in that game, despite the fact that he gave up 4 goals. But the Wild, bit of a different story for them yesterday. I mean, Marc-Andre Fleury, 34 shots against 30 saves. Still pretty good. Still pretty good. There's not too much to complain about for that. But, you know, it's difficult when you give up 5 goals or 4 goals, sorry, and then you have to rely on shootouts. Although from the Wild, I don't know, I was happy to see Marco Rossi with 2 assists. I thought that's quite nice. Look, the Wild's a good team. Although I think that the Kraken are definitely the better of the two. But it'll be interesting to see what ends up happening, because both those teams are sort of playoff contenders, but I wouldn't say either of them are Stanley Cup contenders. But that might give us a good idea of what the fight for a wild card spot might look like in general. So that's a good one. And then again, another high scoring game: Blue Jackets and Avalanche, 6-4 the score. 6 for the Blue Jackets, 4 for the Avalanche. A few multi-point nights. 3 players with 3 points on the Blue Jackets. Chinnikov, Marchenko, and Monahan, all with 3 points. All of them with 1 goal and 2 assists. Beautiful evening for them. Remarkable. Adam Fantilli with a goal also. 2 shots on net. Ken Johnson with a goal also. 2 young guys putting up points. There's no problem with that in my books. But Tarasov, 4 goals against, 30 shots, 26 saves, 0.867. Hey, it's not bad, but it's not great. We'll put it that way. They need a bit better. Now, on the other hand, the Avalanche ended up pulling Georgiev. He's been rough. On 9 shots, he made 6 saves and led in 3 with a 0.667 save percentage. That is a problem, and he is supposed to be Mr. Reliable for them. So I don't know what's going to end up happening. Elliot Friedman talked about it. He posted about it on X or Twitter, whatever you want to call Mr. Musk's new app. Look, Colorado's a great team. They have some really strong players. I mean, Nathan MacKinnon and Kale McCarr actually played pretty well. But if their goaltending persists in such a poor manner, they're not going to be the cup contender that I thought they were. That's a serious issue. serious issue. Now, this might end up being a similar situation to what Edmonton had last year, although I don't foresee that being so. I think really what's going to happen is that Georgia's just going to pick it up. But if he doesn't, he's going to get traded pretty quick, or he's going to find himself in the American Hockey League really fast. And neither of those are things that he wants to have happen. So, yeah, Colorado, no wins yet this year, in large part because of the goaltending, not because of the playing. It's an issue. It's a problem. It's a problem for them, no doubt. And then the Blackhawks beating the Oilers 5-2. I like that game, you know. Teravainen with 2 goals, 2 assists, 4 points, 6 shots on net. A very good game for him. Connor Bedard, 1 goal and 2 assists, 3 points. Very good evening for him also. Seth Jones, 1 goal, 2 assists, 3 points. You know, Chicago is definitely a better team than what they were last year. And I had this conversation yesterday too. I don't know that Connor Bedard will be a 100-point player this season, but he will at the least be an 80-point player, and he could break the high 90s for points, and maybe even beyond and above. And if that ends up being the case, that's great. And also Mrazek, I should just say, had a great game again. 38 shots against, 36 saves, .947. Not too much to complain about. Edmonton, on the other hand, kind of dormant. Draisaitl with 1 goal. McDavid, 1 assist. Ekholm, 1 assist. Corey Perry scoring another one of the goals. Look, Darnell Nurse, I can't even talk about him right now. He's just so bad. So bad. I don't know how this guy's in the NHL. He's essentially tipped the puck into his own net. How many own goals do you have to score to get paid $9 million a year? I'll start scoring them all the time and purely. But he had a rough game. And honestly, so did Bush. Evan Bouchard has not been great so far this year. These guys are supposed to be two of their more reliable players. We know that Nurse isn't super reliable, but the problem here is that Bouchard was so good last year. Edmonton had become so reliant upon him, and they need him because they don't really have too great of a defensive core. If he can't pick it up, then that's going to be a problem. And also, I'll just say Zach Hyman was kind of bad yesterday too. I don't like his game, but I don't think Hyman's as much of an issue. And also, Hyman scoring so many goals, it was a bit of a fluke last year. Let's be quite frank. Hyman's a great player, but he's not Mr. Hockey, and I don't think that's going to persist. Nonetheless, though, the battle of the future and the present, as in McDavid and Bedard, was nice to watch. It's always fun to see. The Ducks got a shutout against the Sharks also. Sharks still without a win so far this year. And there's not too much to be said about that game. I mean, other than that, obviously, Dostal got a shutout because the Sharks didn't score. But, you know, the Sharks had a pretty rough go. But actually, you know what? They didn't even have a rough go. That was just a good game. That was a good game. The shooting was pretty equal. I mean, Vanecek actually only let in 1 goal. One of them was an empty netter. Let's not forget that. So that's not a bad evening at all for them. And then just quickly before we run out of time today, the Flames beat the Flyers 6-3. Pretty dominant performance for Calgary. Again, a really high-scoring game. Travis Konecny, put up 2 goals for the Flyers. And, not too much to be said. I just, like, look, Calgary was the better team. They won the game. That's just sort of how it is sometimes. I thought some guys on the Flyers were going to pick it up a little bit more, but they had a bit of a rough go, and it didn't work out the way that I think they had foreseen it. Flames, on the other hand, you know, Huberto had a really good game. 2 goals, 2 assists, 4 points, 2 shots on net. When you take 2 shots on net and you score 2 goals, you're doing something right. I'll put it that way. But this was a great game, and I think Calgary is going to have a better season than the last. There were reports in the summer that Nazem Kadri, who had 2 goals yesterday, wasn't happy about the direction in which the team was heading. Well, now he's got